Okay, well, this morning we are going to look at the Crusades. For the last couple of weeks, we've been studying the subjugation of the kings of Europe by the papacy, in which the popes basically become the rulers of Europe. And this might rightly be called the domestic policy of the popes. This is what they were moving toward in Christendom. On the other hand, the Crusades might rightly be called the papacy's foreign policy. And as you might expect, the two policies are built upon the same foundation, which is that all things spiritual, all things secular, must be subjugated to the Roman Church, as it must be subject to Christ, because they are the representation of Christ upon the earth. However, the dynamics that led to the Crusades were complex, they were multifaceted, and it is popular today to portray the Crusades as pure Christian aggression. But the reality is that the Crusades were inspired by many factors, not the least of which was a response to Islamic aggression. So we're going to begin this morning with a list of the primary motivations for why the medieval church called for the Crusades. And so I've got a list of things that are in your outline. We're going to go through them one by one. First of all, you have to understand that Christendom was viewed as a theocracy, that God's kingdom is the same as Christendom. And so the medieval church of Rome believed itself to be the literal kingdom of God. And so all things must be subject to the vicar of Christ as they are to Christ himself. And if you remember from an earlier lesson, that word vicar is a form of the word vicarious, which literally means substitute. So the claim here is that the popes being vicars of Christ is the same claim as they are Christ's substitute on the earth until his return. Therefore, it followed that Christendom, this kingdom over which the popes were ruling, was a theocracy. This meant that when the medieval church looked into the pages of Scripture, she saw herself more in terms of the Old Testament theocracy of Israel than the spiritual kingdom of the New Testament. And within that Old Testament model, what she saw there, she saw the Crusades as kind of a reflection of the holy wars that conquered Canaan. Okay? Now, secondly, there was this defense against aggression. This is the most legitimate cause for the Crusades. For 400 years, Islam had been on the attack. Many of the historic lands of early Christianity were now lost to the church. And when the call came for a crusade, during that time frame, we have to understand that Islam still threatened Europe with that same fate. Islam was still invading territories held by Christians. Okay? Third was a response to a cry for help. As we'll see, this was the immediate cause of the Crusades. It is also the least appreciated cause today. But what we see is in that first crusade, there was a plea for help from the Eastern Empire to save it from Islamic aggression. So there's another reason. A fourth reason was this hope for reuniting the East and the West. Remember, they had split. And so this plea for help from the East gave the Roman Church hope that she could reunite the Eastern and Western churches, of course, ultimately under the rule of the Pope. A fifth reason was the protection of pilgrims. Of course, we know that the medieval age was an age of relics and an age of holy places. And the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem was the holiest place of all. And in the year 1010, the Muslims had burnt the church to the ground, but then they themselves quickly rebuilt it. And for a time, Christian pilgrims were given protection to travel to it. But then, in 1076, this situation changed because the Mongol tribes that came out of the east pushed what are known as the Seljuk Turks out of Turkey and into the west, and into the pilgrimage routes. And these Turks at that time were fanatical Muslims, and they began to persecute Christian pilgrims. And so horror stories of atrocities against these unarmed people began to find their way back to Christian Europe, and they were outraged, rightly so. A sixth reason was legal ownership. In the church's opinion, when Christianity basically conquered the old Roman Empire, she believed that all of that territory then belonged to the church. That was the claim of the papacy. And so much of that territory, Palestine and North Africa, and Spain, had been taken by Islam. Therefore, under this perspective, then, the Crusades were viewed as the recovery of the church's legitimate and legal property. So there's another reason. Seventh reason, which is kind of an interesting one, this is a diversion of feudal aggression. This is perhaps the most fascinating and subtle motivation. You remember that it was not that many centuries earlier that the Europeans had been converted barbarians. In many ways, they remained a warlike and savage people in spite of their Christianity. And as we've seen, that some of that aggression had been directed toward the church in these battles between church and state. Now look very carefully at this very first call for the Crusades. We find an interesting and somewhat pragmatic argument. Pope Urban II told the Franks that he was addressing, he said this, that the land of Europe is too narrow for your population. It scarcely furnishes food enough for its cultivators. Hence it is that you murder and devour one another, that you wage wars, and that many among you perish in civil strife. Now, he says, instead of killing your neighbor, go kill as many of the enemies of God as you can reach with your sword. So the appeal that he seems to be making here is that this idea of channeling aggression away from each other and away from Europe and towards the enemies of God. Okay? And then finally, one of the factors in the church's foreign policy was the success of its domestic policy. That is, as the papacy subdued king after king in the West, it only strengthened the belief in its own invincibility. Therefore, it's going to expand its borders. It's going to go conquer this Islamic, this uprising there that had taken its lands. And so it had this sense of its own invincibility. Okay, so these are the motivations. They're very multifaceted and complex as to why the church then issued the call for what are known as the Crusades. Another side of the coin here is then this call goes out. What are the motivations for a crusader to take up the church's call? And again, these are kind of listed in order of importance. And first and foremost, as much as it may disturb us, the overriding factor in taking up the Crusader's cross and going to war was religious devotion. Now, it's a testament, I think, to the Reformation that we find it difficult to reconcile bloodshed with Christian piety. But this was a very different culture with very different sensibilities. Medieval Christians believed that their duty in behalf of the church was the same as Joshua's duty in behalf of the Israelites, which was to conquer God's enemies. That's why the Crusaders' favorite verse was Jeremiah 48:10, which says, "Cursed is he who keeps back his sword from bloodshed." That was their model. Okay? Now, a second reason, we've already mentioned it, is this reverence of holy places. It grew out of a reverence for holy things, the reverence of relics, which had been with the church for centuries now. And as I said, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre was the holiest place of them all. And here was a passion we simply don't relate to today, but the Holy Sepulchre was to medieval Christians what the Temple Mount in Jerusalem was to the Jew. It is difficult in our age, men, of course, as Protestants, to understand the passion that caused people to want to go to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. In fact, one king of England asked of his son that when he died, he would take his heart, literally, and deposit it in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. It was that kind of religious ardor that led many to call the Crusaders armed pilgrims to Jerusalem. That's one of the reasons why they're going, is they're going to force their way to see the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. A third reason was chivalry. It was a part of the code of chivalry that the honor of the king must be avenged. And in this case, it was the honor, they believed, of the King of Kings, Jesus Christ. The chivalrous knight believed it was shameful that the Lord Jesus was not king in his own manner, that is, in Jerusalem. And Islam had driven this good king from his own lands, and he must be returned then to his manor. And so it was also an outrage to these knights, these people that are going by this code of chivalry, that Christian pilgrims were being violated in the Holy Land. That too demanded that honor be avenged. That was the code of chivalry. Okay? Fourth reason, especially in the First Crusade, was personal ambition. This also played a role. Many of the nobles who led the First Crusade were what were called second sons. And what that meant was that because they're not the firstborn sons, they had no land. In most feudal houses in that day, the firstborn son received the entire inheritance. They didn't split it up usually. And so second sons lived on the generosity of their elder brothers. And what we see is in that same first speech that the Pope gave, Pope Urban tells his audience, quote, to wrest the Holy Land from a wicked race and subject it to yourselves. Essentially, he's telling those that are without lands to go conquer lands out of this wicked and evil Islamic rule and make a kingdom of your own out of them. Okay? So again, there's personal ambition that plays a role here. Finally, we have both spiritual and earthly rewards. And what we see is that for the first time in history, indulgences were used as a remission for sins. Up to this point in history, indulgences were actually fairly rare, and they only exempted you from temporal punishment, that is, earthly punishments. But when Pope Urban made this speech, we find within it an amazing declaration. He tells his audience to undertake this journey eagerly for the remission of sins, and be assured of the reward of imperishable glory in the kingdom of heaven. And remember, this is basically the same promise that Muhammad had given to his followers four centuries earlier. And here the church had succumbed to that aspect of Muhammadism. Now this appealed to two extremes in society. On the one hand were the truly religious who sought after a heavenly reward, but on the other hand were the truly guilty who were trying to escape justice because taking up the cross absolved crimes. In fact, the jails were emptied of criminals who were exchanging prison sentences for vows to join the crusade. Okay. Now, the last incentive for the crusader was earthly rewards, and it is said that, of course, to the victors go the spoils. And the poor saw the crusades as a way out of their poverty, and the greedy saw them as a way to fill their pockets. And Pope Urban, again, even used this incentive. For he told them this. He said that Jerusalem is a land fruitful above all others, a paradise of delights. Most people in the West had never gone there. It's actually a very arid place. But their depictions of it and their imagination of it is that here it is, this place, a paradise. Okay? Also, all around Europe, stories began to circulate about the riches of Jerusalem and even of the, quote, dark, beautiful women there. So look at these earthly rewards that you can have by taking up the cross and going conquering this land for yourself. Okay? So you can see then that the motivations of both the church and the crusader are complex, and they varied from person to person, and of course in keeping with each man's own heart. Some went for pure motives. Some went for impure motives. Okay? Any questions on those motivations or comments? Okay? So we're going to ask the question then, given these motivations, were the Crusades morally justified? And of course, I think in large part it depends upon which motivation was uppermost in their minds, right? And the whole question of Christians in war has been a very difficult subject, and we're not going to go into any depth here. But you understand that groups such as the Mennonites and the Amish, as products of the Anabaptists, reject the notion of Christians engaged in war altogether. It's one of the reasons why Luther and other Protestants adamantly opposed the Anabaptists, because even at that time, Islam was constantly trying to drive into the borders of Western Europe, and Christian nations were having to confront that, and yet the Anabaptists are saying, no, we're not going to fight. So they saw that as treason. Okay, so those groups exist. The majority of Christians have rejected that position as too simplistic. And the reason, part of the reason, is that true pacifism would also prevent Christians from being police officers or judges or any other position where judicial force is to be used. And that would contradict the clear teaching of Romans chapter 13, which condones government use of the sword as God's minister to be, quote, as it says, an avenger to execute wrath on him who practices evil. Now, yet even so, there's certainly a difference between maintaining justice and making war. And it was Augustine who first struggled through these questions, and out of that struggle he developed the concept of the so-called just war. And what he said first was this, that violence is not necessarily immoral in every case. He said, if I violently have a man held down while a doctor removes a leg that is filled with gangrene, I am actually saving his life. Or if I come to the defense of someone who is threatened by evildoers, then my fight is morally upright and not evil, even though I'm using force. And so these kinds of concepts became the foundation for his understanding of when a Christian may justly pick up the sword. And so, of course, the question comes back down to motive. Now, of the factors that we looked at for the Crusades, it's my opinion that there is a justification for calling the Crusades a just war based upon the aggression of Islam. The East, remember, the Byzantine Empire, that nation of fellow Christians, was on verge of collapse as Islam was virtually at the gates of Constantinople. And they issued forward a call to please come help us. And in answering that call, I believe they were morally just in doing so. Just as we, I believe, were morally just in going to the aid of Britain in World War II, or Korea during that war, okay? Vietnam in that war. I think it was morally just. Same case here. However, I will say this. I believe it must always be said that even if the Crusades were a just war, there are no just wars that should ever be called a crusade. And here's what I mean by that. The word crusade comes from a Spanish word cruzada and the French word croisade, which both mean marked with the cross. By definition, a crusade is done in the name of Christ, yet Christ is the Prince of Peace. The typical Reform view is that Christians may serve in the military, but they fight in the name of justice, or in the name of defense, but not in the name of Christ. It is very similar to Luther's view of Christians in politics. According to Luther, Christians engage in politics, quote, anonymously. That is, as a citizen, not as a Christian. I am not to be a Christian politician, but I can be a politician who is Christian. And they make the best politicians, in my opinion, and in Luther's opinion. In the same way, I don't fight in the name of Christianity. I don't kill people in the name of Christianity. But there are times that I must fight because of my Christianity. For there are times when it would be immoral to stand by while helpless people are in danger. Okay? And for this reason, then, broadly speaking, I believe the Crusades were misguided in some sense, but they're not immoral. Now, in a more narrow sense, there are always going to be individuals who commit immoral acts during times of war, and that was true of the Crusaders as well, especially during this time period. This is very, very savage fighting, and no quarter was given on either side. And they did atrocities that are shocking. Okay? Now let's take a Reader's Digest version of the major Crusades. The truth is there are actually hundreds of crusades, but they're usually identified under 7 or 8 major movements. Now, the first official call for the crusades took place in the year 1095. The new Byzantine emperor, on behalf of the Christians in the East, as we've said, had asked Pope Urban II for help in keeping the Muslim invaders at bay. The main army in the East, the Byzantine army, had just suffered its worst defeat. And really, the empire was on the verge of collapsing. And so they asked for help. Well, in November, during a council that was held in France, thousands of people gathered together to hear the Pope deliver what turned out to be the most effective speech in history. I'm not going to read it to you, but it's remarkable that it touches on every motivation that we looked at earlier. He touches on every one of those. And by the time that Urban had finished, the crowd was chanting, Deus le vult, which means God wills it. They kept chanting that over and over, God wills it, God wills it. So thousands pledged themselves on that very spot to come to the aid of their fellow Christians to the east. And so the Crusades had begun. And like I said, of the hundreds of Crusades that there were, the following eight or nine stand out as major events. The first event is called the People's Crusade in 1096, which is really a tragic affair. Before the First Crusade, the literal First Crusade, could be formally organized, it was actually preceded by a mob. Thousands of peasants immediately took to the road toward the Holy Land. They were so built up and ready to go. And like most mobs, it quickly lost control. In fact, it is tragic that the first victims of the Crusades turned out to be Jews. Jews who were persecuted along the way as the mobs moved east. As they would go traveling in that direction and they came across Jewish communities, those were the first victims of the Crusades, sad to say. Now, when this ragtag rabble reached Byzantium in 1096, they refused to wait for the regular army. So they marched into Muslim territory, just a bunch of peasants. They were promptly massacred near Nicaea. So it's an inauspicious beginning, to say the least, for the Crusades. This whole rabble is wiped out. The very first crusade is 1095 to 1099. This crusade had no kings. The reason why it had no kings with it is because at that time, Henry IV, William Rufus, and Philip I of France were all under excommunication at the time as the popes were again fighting these heads of state. In many ways, this was the crusade of the so-called Second Sons, because the major figures there were landless nobles looking for a new kingdom to carve out. At Palestine. Now, after reaching the east, one of the first things that the crusaders encountered were the bones of the People's Crusade. In one place, they were stacked up as a huge pyramid, which was a warning left by the Saracens, that is, the Muslims. Don't keep going. Look what happened to your fellow Christians. Okay? Now, as the campaign continued south into Palestine, the conditions there were nearly as horrifying as that pyramid of sun-bleached bones. The crusaders suffered constantly from thirst and starvation. They had to spend month after month conquering every city along the way. And from Byzantium to Jerusalem, they endured one ambush after another, one battle after another. It's amazing that they survived it all. And in 1099, they finally arrived in a state of utter exhaustion outside of the city of Jerusalem. Well, the city refused to surrender. And the crusaders had to conduct yet another long siege to try and wear them down. One of the interesting details was that the crusaders had difficulty making these large, huge siege towers to get to the walls. They're typically made of wood. But there was almost no wood to be found. Why was that? The reason why was because way back in 70 AD, all of the surrounding trees had been cut down by the Romans to conduct their own siege, and it had basically turned the land barren. There were very, very few trees to be found. That's 1,100 years later. We have a question. Well, in many ways, it's similar to our, what you might call our religious crusades today, where people donate money. Nations donated money. Royalty donated money. They had some holdings of their own as far as finances. They may not have had land, but they could have inherited some finances. And of course, you know, basically you launch on a crusade, you're getting on your horse, you've got your weapons, and you live off the land. Anything else? Philip?
So the other side was more of like military. They were more trained.
Oh, yeah.
More. They were more. I mean, they weren't just common people also fighting like the other side.
Well, they would conscript common people as well. But you have to understand they had the advantage of numbers. Crusaders were always outnumbered. And then also they had the advantage of that's where they lived. Therefore, they had access to food and water and these things, you know. And they knew the lay of the land. So you read in the accounts of the Crusades, time after time, these Crusaders wandering through some valley and getting ambushed because the Muslims knew the lay of the land. They knew where to meet them. So again, to me, it's amazing they even made it to Jerusalem. One thing that does help them during this time is that the Islamic peoples in the area are fragmented. They're not united by anything. Okay, so until they become organized, which they will later do under Saladin, it's a little easier for the Crusaders to fight them. Okay. Anything else?
I just wanted to verify, the people or peasants' crusades, is that the same as the first crusade? According to, okay.
No.
That on the screen, it showed different. Notes, it
what,
says,
what did it say?
On the notes, it says a mob of peasants reached the east before the regular army.
Right.
For the first
That's
crusade.
Not called the first crusade, though.
Oh, okay.
It's the actual first crusade is this one here, and it's the actual organized crusade, okay? But before that actually takes place, before the so-called first crusade takes place, there is what's called this peasants or people's crusade, in which this mob just goes in that direction and they get wiped out.
How far was it for these people to go? Like,
well,
like the peasants.
Well, if
they were
I could
probably on foot and how hundreds of miles?
Yeah. I'm afraid to even try to go back. There's a map there. Basically, you think about a lot of, they were coming from various countries. So if you were a crusader coming from, well, let's just talk about the peasants. The call initially goes out in France. So they have to go all the way from France, all the way across Europe, down into Greece, down into what is modern-day Turkey to Constantinople, and then further down into Palestine. To me, it's amazing. But that's the way that's what they did. And they had to march all that distance and live off the land. And I tell you, people that were living in those areas didn't like to see the crusader mobs or armies pass through their territory because there went their food, their crops, everything else. You know, it was tough. Sure.
Well, then were the crusaders, I mean, you say that they're like a mob, but were they like...
Well, the peasants are more like a mob.
Well, you said they went their food, so did they just steal it?
Sure. Yeah. That's the way all armies have done.
I mean, in the name of
until
God.
Modern armies have done. I mean, you look at the Civil War, it's the same way. You know, some farmer in a Civil War doesn't like to hear that either side is going to be passing through his territory because there goes your chicken, your cattle, crops. It's all gone. Okay? You got to feed the army.
Okay.
And people that are living there are going to have to fend for themselves. Anything else? Okay. Thank you. So when they get there, to pick it back up, when they get there, like I said, they have to lay siege to the city. Found it very difficult for a lack of wood. But then finally on July 15th, in the year 1099, the city of Jerusalem finally falls. And we have what is described really as a surreal scene. Because the city had not surrendered under the rules of engagement, no mercy was shown. And so witnesses describe in detail the massacre that took place of the Muslims and the Jews. One said that here you have the victors who are covered from head to foot in blood. From there they go to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And they weep and they offer prayers of thanksgiving, still covered in their enemy's blood. It's really a surreal scene here. And it is certainly difficult to read the details of the destruction. Modern historians like to point out that when the Muslims recaptured the city, the Christians were given mercy. But what they typically fail to mention is that under the rules of medieval warfare, if a city surrenders, as the Christians later did, it is shown mercy. But if it doesn't surrender, as the Muslims refused to do here, they are put to the sword. And that was the practice throughout the entire history of ancient warfare. It was practiced by Christians and Muslims alike. Not to try and excuse it, because these were savage battles and savage things were done. There's accounts of they're trying to break the morale of the city as they're laying siege to it. So they take their prisoners, cut off their heads, and lop them over the walls. Say, this is going to happen to you if you don't give up. So it's a savage, savage time. Now, in any case, the result of the First Crusade was that those crusaders who chose to remain there created a series of Latin kingdoms in the Holy Land. They're kind of like loosely confederated city-states or counties, they're often called. And sadly, they are often plagued by jealousy and ambition, just like you would find in feudal Europe, as they competed against each other instead of helping one another. Now, that's the First Crusade, and they succeed. They carve out a kingdom for themselves in the Holy Land. And then you have the Second Crusade, 1145 to 1148. In the year 1141, the Latin kingdom of Edessa was reconquered by the Muslims. And the other crusader states were too weak to repel them. So the goal of the Second Crusade was to recover this fallen territory. Now, in contrast to the First Crusade, the Second was led by some of the most powerful figures in Europe. The chief spiritual figure, which is the man preaching there, is Saint Bernard. We'll discuss him actually next week. The chief military leaders were King Louis VII of France, the Emperor Conrad III of Germany. And the two forces, German and French, they meet together at Nicaea, then they go on their separate ways, but then meet again at Jerusalem. And there they decided that they would first capture the city of Damascus before moving on to Edessa. And so the armies laid siege to the city. But because of the constant bickering and infighting between these two armies, German and French, they were forced to retreat in 1148. It was a failure. It was a shocking failure. The Christian world could not believe that a crusade that was led by kings and preached by the most revered monk in all of Europe would fail so miserably. But in fact, it was only a foretaste of the Crusades to come, because it's failure after failure after this. And then, Third Crusade. You've got me thinking about the peasants. Any case, okay, the Third Crusade. The Crusade, this one is known as the Crusade of the Kings. It's between 1187 and 1191. In 1174, the Saracens, who had been fragmented, as we said before, were finally united under their great general, Saladin. And in 1187, he forced the Latin kingdom of Jerusalem to surrender the city. He reconquers Jerusalem. And so the mission of the Third Crusade is to recover the city. And now the list of the principal leaders here is like a who's who of European history. You have Frederick, he's the Holy Roman Emperor. You have Philip Augustus, the King of France. You have Richard the Lionheart, King of England. All of these people leading their troops on this crusade. And the Third Crusade is one of the great conflicts of any age because of the exploits of its two primary antagonists, which is Richard the Lionheart and Saladin. Both of these men became legendary figures. I mean, you simply cannot read the exploits of, for example, Richard the Lionheart without being awestruck. Stan and I were at the old city of Jaffa, and there's the account of Richard, and his troops are on these ships, and instead of waiting for the troops to disembark, he jumps over the side and rushes onto the beach almost by himself, fighting this whole army of Muslims. And so his troops are having to hurry to disembark to get to him. Yet he survives and you know, does great things in warfare or whatever. But it's just amazing, the exploits of these men. In any case, even though there's victories here, there's victories at Acre and there's victories at Jaffa, the crusaders simply ran out of steam. And so in the end, Richard was forced to settle for a 3-year truce. And that truce was for the protection of pilgrims in Jerusalem. The Muslims would allow Christians once again to come to Jerusalem. But the city itself remained in Saracen or Muslim hands. Okay? And then the fourth crusade, 1198 to 1204, from the most illustrious crusade, which we just talked about, followed the most disastrous of all the crusades. And now the original plan here was to conquer Egypt. And the reason why is because Egypt was the homeland of the Muslims who were currently holding Jerusalem. They thought if they could conquer them there, they would by default get Jerusalem. And so the plan was to ship the crusaders across the Mediterranean Sea, and they did that by contracting the ships out from the Venetian fleet, all these merchants there in Venice. But when the crusaders arrived at Venice, they were short of money. They couldn't pay the price. And at the time, the city of Venice and its merchant fleets were run by some of the most ruthless capitalists in history. And so the Venetians struck a bargain. In exchange for transporting the crusaders to Egypt, the crusaders first had to sack the city of their chief rival. They became mercenaries, basically. And so the crusaders accepted this. They crossed into Greece. They burnt the city of Zara to the ground. While they're there, another group of Greeks saw this as an opportunity. I mean, here was this entire army of potential mercenaries. So what they did is they asked the crusaders to overthrow the current Byzantine emperor in favor of his brother. And the crusaders accepted that. So they marched then on to Constantinople. And while they're doing this, Pope Innocent is saying, wait, you're supposed to go to Egypt. I'm excommunicating the entire lot of you. But it didn't help. The crusaders overthrew the emperor. They put their employer on the throne. Problem was that the man failed to pay the price. So on April 12, 1204, the great city of Constantinople, the capital of the Roman Empire, unconquered for 800 years, was looted and half destroyed by the crusaders. These are the very people that the crusades originally set out to save. And here they are, butchered in 3 days of massacre. And so never again would there be any sense of Christian kinship between East and West, which was another casualty of this shameful Fourth Crusade. And then followed perhaps the most tragic, which is known as the Children's Crusade in the year 1212. This is really a minor crusade, but it's easily the most pitiful. In May of the year 1212, a 12-year-old boy named Stephen began preaching in France of a new crusade. And this young boy quickly gained notoriety. And he said that the reason for the failures of the past crusades had been because of the sins of the crusaders. In other words, they're not, quote, innocent. And for this reason, then, God had not blessed the crusades with victory. But he said his new crusade would be much different. He announced that he would lead a band of innocents, that is, of children, to the sea. And he prophesied that the waters would then part like they did in front of Moses. And the Mediterranean would part. The young warriors would then cross on dry land to the Holy Land. And that God would free Jerusalem in a miraculous deliverance. So around the end of June, thousands of children, not any of them over 12 years old, gathered together in groups and began marching to the sea. But when they arrived in Marseille, the sea lay before them and it did not part. And so day after day, they kept gathering at the shore expecting this miracle. But it didn't happen. Well, after a time, two merchants, their names are Hugh the Iron and William the Pig. I don't think I trust someone called William the Pig. In any case, these two men offered to put these children on ships and to carry them to the Holy Land free of charge. And so Stephen agreed. And the children were placed in 7 ships and they sailed out into the sea. And they were never seen again. Of the thousands who left, only one was ever heard from again. 18 years later, in the year 1230, a single survivor made it back to France. So what had happened to the children? What happened? Well, it turned out that two of the ships had been sunk during a storm with no survivors. As for the other five ships, it turned out that Hugh the Iron and William the Pig had sold these children into slavery. The ships had rendezvoused with a Saracen fleet, a Muslim fleet, and the children were taken to North Africa, never to return. So they were betrayed. Pitiful. And then followed the Fifth Crusade. Oh, Philip?
Yes, just like Stephen had said, God was absent, not favoring either side of these wars. Could I say that?
I'm not going to presume to understand God's motivations in every one of these situations. Obviously, he did not grant success for the Christians. In his providence, we know that ultimately all things work together for those who are truly Christian. But as far as these individual events, he withheld his blessing on these. And you can see why, being presumptuous enough to say, we're going to march down to the sea and it's going to open, because, first of all, problem is, you're not innocent. That would be the first thing you say.
I was just wondering, what were the parents' thoughts on this? Did they heed to Stephen's thoughts? I mean, did they feel like this was God was speaking through Stephen and they allowed their children to go?
Because I'm sure there was a lot of that, yeah. I mean, of course, all of Europe is caught up in the crusading spirit to begin with. But then when you come up with something like this, which speaks about these miraculous things are going to take place, and how it kind of made sense in their minds to, well, the whole problem is this. I mean, it's true, it's the sin. But the problem is that these children aren't innocent, and they had not heard from God. Okay.
You know, I would have thought, even as a 12-year-old, that whenever you got there and the sea didn't part, something would have went ding, 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 ding. This is not God's will.
Isn't that common among most false prophets? They give their prophecy, and when it doesn't turn out, the prophecy changes.
Exactly. Let's do this instead.
You can see that on television all the time.
Right.
Yeah. Anything else? Okay. Fifth Crusade would be next. 1217 to 1221. And once again, this is the object here is to conquer Egypt. This time the crusaders did make it across the sea. They didn't sack their own cities and the cities of their friends. They did make it across the sea. They successfully took the great tower there that protected the Nile River. And it was at this point that the crusaders really missed a golden opportunity, because the Egyptians offered the Christians all of the Holy Land. You can have it all if you'll just spare Cairo. And they should have taken that offer. Instead, the Christians refused, and so the crusaders marched inland. They were soundly defeated. The only inspirational episode of this crusade was to see the courage of St. Francis of Assisi, who we will talk about next week. Here he is, a man of peace. He crosses the enemy lines in order to preach the gospel to the Egyptian sultan, the head of the Muslims there. He crosses the lines at great danger to himself just to preach the gospel. Okay. Of course, he was unsuccessful at converting the man. The crusaders were unsuccessful at defeating him. So again, the crusade is a failure. Then the Sixth Crusade. We've actually discussed this crusade in passing last week, because in 1221, it was Frederick II who launched his own crusade, really as a part of his struggle with the Pope. The crusade ended in a treaty with the Saracens, in which Jerusalem was given back to the Christians for a period of 10 years, with the one exception of the Dome of the Rock. In 1229, Frederick crowned himself King of Jerusalem in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. For doing that, he was excommunicated for the fourth time. He returned to Germany. Not long after the 10 years were up, the Saracens easily took Jerusalem once again. Okay? Followed by the Seventh Crusade in 1248 to 1250. Once again, it seemed like the best way to get Jerusalem was to defeat Egypt, so they organized again, crossed the Mediterranean Sea again. The principal figure was probably the most devoutly Christian king of all the Middle Ages, Louis IX, who is called St. Louis. He's canonized. In 1249, Louis captured the mouth of the Nile again, but just like those before him, when he moved toward Cairo, his army was cut off, surrounded. Louis himself was captured, ransomed for a huge amount of gold. What's interesting, you can see the moral character of Louis, that when the ransom is finally paid, his men then boasted that they had cheated and not paid the entire amount. And Louis was outraged, and he made them send that amount to the Saracens. Okay. Louis then spent 4 years in Palestine reinforcing Crusader castles, but he never entered Jerusalem. That was his greatest wish, but he would not do it as simply as a pilgrim. He wanted to do it being a Christian city, but it was not to be. And then the final and eighth crusade, it's really a continuation of the seventh. It was the last desperate attempt of Louis and his brother to conquer the Holy Land, to preserve it. It was about to fall, whatever kingdoms were left there. They intended to attack Cairo again, but they were sidetracked to the city of Tunis, and there the crusaders were struck by typhus and dysentery. And the accounts of the crusade here are just horrifying. I hesitate to be this graphic, but the dysentery was so bad, it is said that Louis actually cut a hole in the seat of his trousers so he could continue to march as he was under this ailment. Okay, eventually he died of it. And so in 1291, the last of the crusaders' cities, the city of Acre, fell to the Saracens. That ended the century of Christian presence in the Holy Land. And all the effort that was expended toward these crusades came to nothing. Now, there are some effects that happened from the crusades, and that's what we want to close with. What were the results of all of this effort? There's actually more here than might appear at first glance. The initial enthusiasm for the Crusades really helped bring the papacy to its greatest heights. Here's the Pope, he is our leader. We're going to go march into battle for him. And so the crusading spirit worked against the kings in their struggles with Rome that we looked at last week. But then on the other hand, the fact that the Crusades failed, it tarnished the image of the popes. It sowed the seeds of doubt about their claims of divine supremacy. I mean, certainly, God had not blessed the crusading efforts of the popes. So there's a seed of doubt there. Secondly, the crusades created an atmosphere of intolerance. Eventually, crusades were launched not only against Islam, crusades were launched against heretics, they were launched against Jews. In fact, it's Pope Innocent III who ordered that all Jews and Muslims must wear special colored patches on their clothing. So it is sad to say that Nazi Germany did not invent that practice. They only revived a medieval papal policy. Third, the Crusades brought the philosophy of the ancient Greeks back to the West, especially that of Aristotle. And it was the rediscovery of Aristotle, it had profound impacts upon the future of theology, especially in the form of scholasticism. We'll talk about that in a later lesson. It also had an impact upon the future of culture in the form of the Renaissance. We will also talk about that in a future lesson. So that's one of the things, is they went east and then came back, they brought with them some of the culture of the Greeks, of the ancient Greeks. And then fourth, the seeds of the Reformation were sown in three ways. First of all, the Crusades began a spirit of nationalism. You understand that prior to the Crusades, loyalty centered around the local nobility. But here the Crusades united men into this larger national context. Huge armies of Germans and French all together. And so that kind of gave them a greater loyalty to their own nation. What that did then is it took away their loyalty from who? The popes. Okay, so you see that trend begin. And then another impact, another seed of the Reformation, is the system of indulgences. We talked about that earlier. Out of the Crusades, then, the church began trafficking in eternal rewards. And if you remember, it's this same system of indulgences that became the immediate cause of Luther's attacks on the church. And this whole system of indulgences really picks up steam during the Crusades, basically promising that if you'll go on a crusade and fight for the cause of Christ, you'll have an eternal reward. Okay? Well, then the church began saying, well, if you do this, if you do that, you'll have this eternal reward. And that's the whole abuse of indulgences. Exactly right. Exactly right. We talked about that in passing a little earlier, that basically the church began doing exactly what Muhammad had promised. If you will shed blood in the name of Christ against his enemies, you'll receive a reward. That's exactly what Muhammad had said. Go kill the enemies of Allah, and you'll have that eternal reward. And then the last seed of the Reformation is sown in that the Crusades here, although they're intended to preserve the Eastern Empire, they actually weaken it instead. Remember, they actually partly destroy the city of Constantinople. They never fully recovered from that. And so about 200 years after the last Crusade, this whole empire, the Byzantium Empire, fell to the Turks. And so the Greeks fleeing out of there to the west, they brought with them original Greek manuscripts. What that did was help fuel a revival of interest in the Greek language. And so that led to a new translation of the New Testament from the original languages instead of the Latin Vulgate. That led to a new appreciation of biblical studies, which led to Luther, which led to the Reformation. Okay? So ultimately, we see the irony here that by pursuing Rome's supremacy in the Crusades, the popes actually sowed the seeds of her greatest loss, which was the Reformation. Okay, one final comment as we close. We have to say that whether the Crusades were a just war or not, and we've talked about that, they were certainly a horrible waste of life. The Crusaders endured unspeakable sufferings in the name of Christ, but God still withheld his blessing. Instead, the Crusades turned out to be an indictment of the entire medieval system, which had turned Christianity into a religion of holy works, of holy things, and of holy places. And it is tragic that so many were willing to die to reach the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, when it was there that the angels had asked, "Why do you seek the living among the dead?" Christianity is about a risen Lord, not an empty tomb. Okay? Loopy, would you close, please?